Intersections is recorded, produced, and distributed on the territories that have been stolen from the Coast Salish nations of the Squamish, Musqueam, and Tsleil-Waututh peoples. The members of the Gender Empowerment Collective seek to dwell within and reckon with these historical truths of dispossession and violence as we dream and curate conversation towards more whole worlds.
Good morning and welcome to Intersections as presented by the Gender Empowerment Collective. We're here at CITR 109 FM broadcasting from UBC on the traditional, ancestral, and unceded lands of the Musqueam people. Every 2 weeks on Tuesdays at 10 a.m. we host a panel with collective members or an interview with an expert about topics surrounding gender, race, and social justice. Let's get intersectional.
So hello, everybody. Today we are joined by Bridget Mopera, who is an awesome local Vancouver entrepreneur. Her company is called Womankind and focuses on making candles, beautiful candles, by the way, that are representative of diverse shades and body types, which really goes along with the discussion that we started having last week on our last episode surrounding sort of body positivity and body neutrality, just sort of these concepts of acceptance towards all kind of like shades and body types. So Bridget, I just wanted to start the discussion by asking you about kind of your artistic background. What kind of got you into making these candles?
I started making candles around when the quarantine first started. I originally made this just as gifts for my friends and my family, and then it kind of just fell in love with the process of making candles. It was so like therapeutic for me at that moment because there wasn't that much things that we could do. So making candles kind of like helped me relax. And then I noticed that I could make a brand out of this. Like I could make something out of this. And that's how I started Womankind. Yeah, I was really working hard on creating that smooth, perfect look for each candles, which I kind of struggled with. So when I saw the candles, kind of like they have the frosting all over, they were all like uniquely different from each other when I unmolded them, I was like, this is what I want my brand to be. I kind of like saw myself within the candles, and that's why I started Womankind.
Yeah, so that aspect of you sort of like seeing yourself in them, that sort of like goes along with something that you've previously mentioned, that you sort of want to use these candles to sort of celebrate women of color as they are. And you stated that like it wasn't necessarily easy growing up being confident due to like these sort of beauty standards. So sort of how does that play into like your creativity and your company?
For Womankind, I really want to let people know that we have the ability to create our beauty standard. I feel like growing up, especially social media nowadays, they give us this look of what beauty needs to be. And then in Womankind, I want us to define our own beauty. And so I'm planning on making more shades and more sizes as well. So I feel like I want people to look at the candles and kind of think like, oh, this is me, this is what I represent. And they feel connected to the candle. And then they realize that, oh, I am beautiful, and then their flaws needs to be embraced as well. Kind of like that.
Yeah, totally. That makes sense.
Yeah, that's great to hear, because I remember in the Daily Hype article, you said that you wanted to help people embrace their whole body, even if it means that, you know, some bodies may have scars and, you know, they may not look like what you originally, like when you originally started out making the candles, you probably thought like, oh, this is like what, like everything being like so smooth is a bit unrealistic, right? Like we see that all the time in like media and like all these like social media narratives and like media in general. So it's great to see that like your company is like encouraging people to embrace who they are. So yeah. And also I came across this article recently that mentioned that skin lightening is like a massive industry, and it like preys on the insecurities of people of color, especially women. So I was wondering, like, what are your thoughts on like on this industry in general? Because like it can be very, it can put a lot of pressure like on women, particularly.
Mm-hmm. Growing up being Filipina, the beauty standard in the Philippines is actually a lot similar here in Canada, or like just very Americanized. A lot of darker Filipinas, we all have these like lightening soaps that you use so you can like lighten your skin. Some people bleach their skin to look white. And I think this is, it's really sad to see that so many women feels like they need to change so many things about them in order to be accepted in society, or just in order to be called beautiful. But like I said, we all define our own beauty. So everyone's like really different. And it's sad that other women feels like they need to change something about them in order to be accepted. But you can't really blame them, because social media nowadays, they portray so many things about what you should look like. So I feel like that affects so many emotions that you feel like you have to change. I'm sorry, I don't know if I'm making sense right now, but yeah.
No, you're definitely making sense, don't worry.
Yeah,
I feel like during interviews, it's easy to kind of get like hung up on what you're saying,
yeah.
But in the end, you're actually making way more sense than you think.
Okay.
You are. But yeah, I think that skin lightening conversation is so interesting, just because I think that it really goes to show kind of the way that our insecurities are profited off of, and kind of like you said, they're almost manufactured. It's like they want people to be insecure, because then that skin lightening industry is really common in almost like every single culture where skin tones are typically darker. And then you go and you look in North America and you look at the Kardashians, who've like made a whole brand off of making themselves darker than they actually are.
Everyone wants to like tan. So like people are never satisfied with what you look like. It's either you're too white, you're too dark, like there's nothing in between. I think they always group you into the categories and see where you belong. So people, you always change what they look like because they want to be a part of something. Like I said, like for Filipinas, some Filipino women, they want to be light, some wants to be darker. So it's like you really never know what will satisfy someone. That's why I want to empower women to find your own beauty, whatever you're comfortable with, whatever you feel confident in, and the rest doesn't matter. If you love what you look like, you love what you look like without other people's opinion.
Yeah, I think that's a really powerful message, just because, yeah, it's so true. Really, with the standards that are set right now, it's pretty much designed to make sure that nobody is ever actually satisfied with how they are. And if you kind of turn that inwards and make yourself in control of what your own standard is, I feel like that is like the first step to actually being like empowered and freed from those expectations.
Yeah.
You also mentioned how that definitely translated to what your customers are looking for, right? Because like so many people, like they don't see themselves like represented in the social media narratives and like old media narratives that are floating around. So like your creations like definitely help customers like to see themselves, like embrace their natural state. So that's definitely very exciting. That goes into what I'm interested in chatting to you about today, which is how, like, I love how the mission of Womankind is about encouraging people to be kind to themselves, in addition to representing all kinds of body types. And so could you tell me a little more about your creative process, like how you decide what set of designs you want to experiment with in a particular day in the studio, for example?
For me, Womankind is all about, I want people to feel valued. Like I want each individual to look at my candles and see like, and feel connected with it, like I said. Like you said earlier, there's not enough social media portrayals of curvy plus size women or women of color. It's always the skinnier ones, the beauty standard, which we call, and I want Womankind to be the kind of brand that represents everybody. Especially for me, I'm always the type of person who wants everyone to feel heard, wants everyone to feel valued. And if through Womankind, I can create these candles and make people feel like they're beautiful and they're valued. And it, yeah.
And I understand previously you were using Instagram to take orders and you launched a website just last week, recently. And so that was great to see too. And so before we get into questions about the website, I just wanted to like hear your thoughts about the recent TikTok trend that's going around, where like social media is trying to embrace different body types, like different influencers, they're trying to show bodies in their natural state. And like, what are your thoughts about that as it relates to like Womankind's mission?
I think it's great. I think it's great that people are being more open to different body types nowadays. Mm-hmm. And I think authenticity is really important when it comes to big brands, because it's really hard to believe, like, are they doing this to actually support plus size women, or are they doing it because it's a trend? Because it's really difficult, but I am really glad that they are becoming more open to it and more embracing to different cultures, different body sizes. And most companies should be like this. Like, it's not asking for too much. I feel like it should be a standard to embrace all body types and not just a trend.
Right, yeah. So speaking of trends, when you mentioned that you want people to be able to create their own beauty standards, like in a way, like even though right now, like social media, they're trying to combat like the main trend of like perfect, flawless bodies. Like you mentioned, it is important for people to kind of get into the headspace of, you know, like we're not always going to have those days where we feel like being on social media, like either even while embracing our natural state. Mm-hmm. So that's why, yeah, another reason why I'm like really excited about this project that you have going on. About the website, how has customer reception been so far to the huge variety of like body types that you want to represent in your work?
It's pretty good. I love hearing customers tell me that they enjoy reading the about me section and why I started it. I love, like earlier today, I woke up and a customer DM me saying that she felt empowered with my website. She felt empowered with the reels that I post or the captions that I put. And I feel like when someone tells me, like even like one or two people, because I'm a small business, I just started, so there's not that much audience yet. But those one or two people that like DMs you, then takes the time out of your day to tell you how much I empowered them means so much. And I cannot wait for my company to grow. I'm loving where I am right now. I think I'm doing great. I love it. I can't wait to for Womankind to grow and empower more and more people.
Yeah, that's awesome. Cause like, especially during COVID, like people are spending more time online, and obviously the amount of media that they consume like online increases too. And just having that positive influence that really makes a difference, because it's the little things that add up,
yeah.
Right? And so I guess that is also what social media is trying to combat right now, but having that like additional like affirmation, like I just love the way that your site is designed to like kind of embrace viewers as they explore the site too. So that's great. And so expanding on like the customer reception, in the article, you've also mentioned that there are still people out there who think that, you know, women should cover up, women should be quiet, and you wanted to brand your product so that women can express themselves freely. So those particular reactions, like, does that describe what you encountered as part of, like, the reception to the work, like some people's reception to the work, or are you referring to societal views in general?
A little bit of both. When I do my pop-ups, you obviously get different reactions. They're mostly people, like, they immediately know what mind brand represents just by looking at the candles. But some people, they kind of like, they don't really understand the meaning behind it. All they see is a woman's body. And like, especially nowadays, like, women are overly sexualized. That even a candle, they sexualize it too. Like, some laugh and be like, oh my God, boobs. They kind of like that. Or like, you know, look at that butt. It's like, little comments like that make me realize that other, like, there's so many people with different perspectives that I cannot expect everyone to immediately get my brand. But that's why I'm here for. That's why I'm here for, to kind of like tell people the world that a woman's body is not here to be sexualized. It is to be appreciated without sexualizing it, which I think is possible. Some people, they immediately think, oh, it's a body candle. It's a curvy body candle. And they immediately see that little, the bust or the butt part. And I'm just like, it's more than that. It's more of the story behind it too.
Yeah, and I think that's really an important perspective. And it kind of like reminds me back to what you were saying before about like how like certain body types are like a trend almost. And like, I think that kind of goes hand in hand with the sexualization aspect. Like,
yeah.
I keep on hearing like discourses about like how like, oh, like the thick body type, like going like out of style or in style. And I'm like, isn't that so insane that our bodies are like so objectified to the point that they go in and out of fashion? And I think that your company is like, and companies like yours are actually owned by like women of color who like have these like mentalities behind their business. So I think it's really important because I think it's really pushing against like this sort of like capitalist idea of like bodies are to be like consumed and like sold and stuff like that. So I think it's really cool.
Thank you.
Yeah, like bodies as a commodity, especially like in the weight loss industry and like any industry that's like trying to sell like a certain narrative so you can like make your body different to like fit certain standards or like alter your body. So definitely like the mission of womankind, it definitely contributes to like a very like empowering influence. I know that Peyton wanted to discuss more with you on like one of your social media posts that specifically mentions stretch marks. So I thought I'll turn it over to her now.
I think that you were sort of touching on this before. I really just wanted to sort of end things with like kind of where you see the company going and like where you see yourself expanding to. And yeah, that's like when we noticed that on social media, you made a post that was sort of mentioning like women embracing like their stretch marks. That kind of sort of like hinted to me that you sort of want to expand the kind of stuff that is represented in your work. And like, I just kind of wanted to like put it out there, like what kind of plans do you like see for the future of your business? What kind of stuff do you want to create in the future when you sort of like build the capacity to do so?
I definitely, like I said, I want to add more shades of colors in there. I want to add not just the curvy body that I have right now. I want to add more. I want to add more body rolls. I want to add the stretch marks too. I want to add the hyperpigmentations. And I think it's because, like I said, I have all of these. Like, I have the stretch marks, I have the rolls, I have the curves, and I feel like it's a lot easier to connect to people who also have these through my work. And definitely in the future, I cannot wait to add more body shapes too. Like, I'm really excited for that. Right now, I'm focusing on what I have right now. But I have all these ideas on top of my head that I kind of just like, I always list it down because I don't want to forget them, but I'm so excited to be working on it. These candles aren't just for me, like they're not just to represent me. I want them to represent the plus size women too. I want them to feel connected and make them feel that they're not alone, because I've always had stretch marks and I didn't think much of it till I saw social media kind of like bringing women down who has it, which I was so surprised because it never bothered me. But after seeing posts like that, I was like, wait a minute, like this never bothered me. But now I'm like thinking to myself, like, oh, is it ugly? Is it not? But it's not, like, it's natural. It's your, you know, it's a body isn't made to be perfect. Like, it's like there's no such thing as a perfect body. And I think that I'm really excited for womankind to be telling people that as a message.
Yeah, I think that really beautifully sums up your sort of whole mission with your company. Yeah, so I believe that that is all the questions that we have for you today. Again, we just wanted to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us. We really appreciate it. And yeah, we wish you the best of luck with Womankind, and I'm sure you're about to see a lot of success to come.
Thank you. Thank you, guys.
Thanks.
I appreciate it, yeah.
Tribe Called Red is the Hallucination with their new record, One More Saturday Night, featuring Javia Mighty, Tanya Tagak, and more out now.
What's wrong?
I want to go to therapy, but I can't afford it.
Well, did you know there's a show on CITR where you can get free therapy every other week?
Really? What's it called?
It's called Therapy Hour, and it airs every other Tuesday at 6 p.m.
You mean I can get free therapy every 2 weeks just by listening to the radio?
That's right, and it doesn't even cost you a dime.
Wow. I won't have to cry anymore.
Actually, crying is pretty good for you. I learned that by listening to Therapy Hour on CITR 101.9 FM, because everyone needs therapy.
But not everyone can afford it. You get what you need.
Hello, and welcome back to Intersections. I'm Randy. I am the Gender Empowerment Collective lead. I'm joined today by Elle.
Hey, I'm Elle. I'm a member of the Gender Empowerment Collective.
And we are also joined by a special guest today. Welcome, Layla Cameron. We are very happy to have you today.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to chat with you.
Yeah, we're quite interested to have, in our last episode, we talked about this topic of anti-fatness, fat phobia, body positivity, body neutrality. And so we're really interested to have you as a guest to kind of dive more into these topics and like hear about how they are part of your work. So to start us off, can you just tell us a little bit more about yourself, your work as a PhD student, as a filmmaker, and then yeah, just like your research?
For sure. So I am a PhD candidate at SFU in the School of Communication, and my research or my dissertation is looking at fatness in reality television. But more specifically, I'm sort of looking at this evolution from traditional approaches to fatness, which are very violent, to a more body positive approach, and then these very new contemporary shows that border on fat positivity, and sort of looking at like the stickiness of these texts as sort of Western societies shift their understandings of the body and fatness. As a filmmaker, I've made one short documentary film called Fat Hiking Club, which followed an organization called Fat Girls Hiking based in Portland as they expanded their chapters and went international by coming to Vancouver. I'm also working on a podcast called The Fatten Pod, which the first season is called Fat in YVR, and it's interviewing different fat folks working in Vancouver in different industries to make the city a little more fat friendly.
Yeah, that all sounds really interesting.
Yeah, I'd love that. Well, I'd just love to like, I have a question about the hiking group and like just the nature of it, right? And how it is kind of like a place of refuge, but also like from oppressive narratives, but also a place of like growth that can happen, an expansion, right? And so maybe you could talk a bit more about that and just like what led you to want to like create a space like that for people to come into in a world where maybe that's not the most just like acceptable thing to like create a group for people in that way. But yeah, I'm just interested in hearing more about how, like, what took you there.
Well, when I first moved to Vancouver, I'm from Toronto, and I moved out here just with one intention, and that was to spend some time outside and explore and do all the like stereotypical things people do out here. And I shortly realized that, or I kind of felt like I was the only fat person on the trails when I would go hiking. And then when I went to go shopping for gear or technical clothing, I couldn't find anything in Vancouver. And it got me thinking about, you know I'm not the only fat person in this city. So where are they and how do they function? How do they survive? And I went online and the closest group that I could find was Fat Girls Hiking in Portland, which is about, 6 to 8 hours away. And as someone trained in documentary filmmaking, I was curious. So I called them and had a great conversation with Summer. And after speaking with her, sort of realized that this would make an excellent documentary film. So that's really where the project came about. In terms of sort of the advocacy or the impact producing with the project, which is maybe more relevant to your question. I mean, there was some tricky territory that I had to navigate when making this film, because I really didn't want to appease or give into any of these sort of what Stacey Bias calls the good fatty archetypes. And one of those is the fat lead, or this idea that fat people can be good people despite their fatness if they're physically active. And I had a personal interest in hiking, and I wanted to make this film because it had all of the technical elements. I had intimate access to Summer. I had a really great sort of narrative arc, and I knew that this was a feasible project. But I also knew that for a mainstream audience, including body positive spaces, that this was going to be a film that still pandered to their implicit biases about fat people. And that was tricky. And I think that I don't know if I was like fully successful in terms of creating a fat positive space with that film alone. I think it acts as a conversation starter about these issues in terms of outdoor recreational culture, physical activity, fatness, as well as morality. And so it's tricky. I think the subject about fitness and fatness is very tricky. I personally do not align myself with body positivity or any of that rhetoric. I am fully fat positive in my work and my approach to different subjects or projects. Body neutrality is something that I think is very valid and valuable, but I'm mostly invested in fat positive rhetoric. Some of the ways I tried to mitigate that was I didn't include audio of heavy breathing. I didn't include the typical shots of fat folks, you know, from bottom up that emphasize or make the body appear larger. I tried to avoid close-up shots of sweat. All of these types of shots are used in mainstream media to sort of vilify fatness and show fatness as a threat to life or as something that causes a lot of struggle. So I do think that Fat Hiking Club in a way did create, like you said, a positive space, but I think it's still a very complex space in which the boundaries are not solid. There's still a lot of sort of leakiness with attitudes about physical activity and health and vitality. So moving forward, a lot of my projects don't focus on fitness for that reason. I don't know that I can, that I have a solid approach that aligns fat positive ideology with these conversations about physical activity, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. I really appreciate how like well thought through and spoken you are about this, because it shows that like it's been a really like it's close to your heart and you care about it deeply, like what you are studying and what you're creating. And yeah, that was like another thing that came up in my mind of like, what are like the limits within this? And like, are they always just supportive or just restrictive? Like, I can see how you don't want to become too concrete in like one way of thinking about fitness and one way of like pushing it forward within a group. And you want to leave space for like growth and mutual conversation, but it can be difficult, right, when you're like putting an umbrella like over a category of people or whatever. But yeah, thank you for elaborating on that, and if you want to say any more you can.
I do think that a lot of this reflection is also related to my own sort of neuroses and overthinking and fear of criticism from fat community as well. Like, I'm very mindful of all of the different perspectives while also wanting to acknowledge that I am one person, right, with my own positionalities, and I can't, you know, save the world, so to speak. That being said, I do think that this approach is often used by folks who are familiar with the fat positive or fat liberationist method of operating from with the most marginalized of our community in mind. And so a lot of this stems from and overlaps with things like disability studies or disability justice activism, where it's very wary to position certain activities as like morally good, because for many reasons, those activities are not of interest or accessible to folks. So I think that it's grounded in a lot of other sort of perspectives or intersections that are really important to this conversation. But yeah, I also think it just stems from my own neuroses and overthinking too. And I recognize that.
I feel like most things do, right? Like the things that we end up creating in life come from our own, like, oh my God, what do I need right now? And we end up like giving gifts to other people at the same time. So it sounds really wonderful.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah, I like when you mentioned the like understanding the connection between morality and fatness. I think that's definitely like a link that a lot of people don't get or like make their own connection with. But I do think that connection with morality relates to kind of like the next thing I want to talk about. So there's been kind of like, you know, maybe like a resurgence or maybe not a resurgence because it's just now happening, but a discussion of this connection between white supremacy and anti-fatness and like the history. So I personally, in my book club, just finished reading Fearing the Black Body, The Racial Origins of Fat Phobia by Sabrina Strings. And so I'm just wondering if you can speak more to how this history informs like the work and the research that you do specifically within this field of anti-fatness.
Yeah, it's definitely a key factor in the foundations of anti-fat bias and stigma. And I will say as well that the roots of fat activism can be located in the work of people of color and women of color, especially on the West Coast of the United States. There is another book that I would recommend called The Embodiment of Disobedience by Andrea Shaw, which is related to Sabrina Strings's work. But I mean, I should acknowledge, considering that this is audio format, that I am a white settler. And so my positionality informs my approach or how I can discuss these topics or should discuss these topics. But critical race theory just provides such an important foundation for these conversations about anti-fatness, because that morality component it reveals how fat stigma is one of the pillars of white supremacy. So as we shift towards, you know, what we consider to be a more modern Western society, and we look to separate ourselves from things that we consider more primitive or of the past, or as not conducive with capitalism and production, fatness, of course, gets bound up in that. And I don't think that we can separate the fact that the fat body is also associated with a racialized body. And I think that there's a lot to learn as well from racialized communities and from people of color, because there is a lot of research that also talks about how those communities do not necessarily have the same type of fat shame or values around fatness that white communities do, which again goes to show that anti-fat bias is one of the core pillars of white supremacy. And I think that tells us a lot as well in terms of how we approach fatness now and our attempts to treat it. Those histories parallel, like for example, I consider a lot of anti-fat medical interventions as a form of eugenics, and eugenics movements have targeted people of color for a very long time. So a lot of our history, there's just a lot of messiness and overlap, and you can't really think about one without the other.
Yeah, I that's really interesting. I like how you, yeah, like the messiness of it all, because I think like a lot of times our brain wants to like pick it apart and be like, oh, I'm gonna focus on this, but like you can't focus on it. And yeah, reading that book really gave me like an understanding of like how it has been shaped over time. Which I think a lot of people just, they look at like the 2000s and like, obviously that's the most recent like form of fat phobia and like anti-fatness that we're like used to seeing, like especially in the media. But yeah, it's so interesting, like looking at the art, like through the Renaissance and like seeing how, you know, it was just shaped by like a certain group of people, white people.
Yeah. I mean, I think, one of my dear friends, Kate Patterson, called me in about this, and we had a really interesting discussion that I will always hold very close, because I, at the beginning of my PhD studies, thought that I had to really narrow myself down to only working within fat studies and fat studies scholarship, which is an intersectional discipline, but I didn't really understand or hold to a high regard the racial implications of anti-fatness. And something that Kate told me was, she said, well, anti-fat bias can never be solved until racism is, and not that these things can be solved, but until we acknowledge racism, because that is one of the foundational aspects from which fat stigma is inspired from. And just sort of acknowledging where fat stigma almost intersects in that sort of framework or hierarchy, if you will, was really important for me in terms of how I think about my work and my projects. And, you know, whose voices should be centered in these conversations? Who is the most, like I said before, in terms of being mindful of who is the most marginalized in our communities, and how we should probably be, or not how we probably, how we should be starting from there. I think too, when you think about fat white folks and how they tend to be stereotyped or approached, really does a good job of showing that hierarchy. So for example, if we think about the stereotype of rednecks in the American South, that is an attempt to create a racialized other within the a group of white people. And we, one of the ways that we do that, or one of the defining characteristics of that stereotype, is fatness. And so these things, that kind of, that example just shows how all of these things intertwine in this really messy way, but ultimately serve to support white supremacy. Yeah, I think, yeah, to try to encapsulate that thought.
21st edition of Doxa Documentary Film Festival returns May 5th to 15th, 2022. Committed to cultivating curiosity and critical thought, Doxa will present both short and feature films from across Canada and the globe, representing some of the best in documentary cinema. The hybrid in-person online festival will include both live and pre-recorded conversations with filmmakers, as well as some industry-specific events. Visit doxafestival.ca for more details.
TransCare BC works to enhance the coordination of trans health services across the province and offer expanded health services to support transgender communities. They are doing this by developing gender-affirming client-centered models of service, ensuring access to gender-affirming and supportive healthcare that is equitable and available, and supporting network development to make sure trans and gender-diverse individuals, their families, and healthcare providers have access to information, resources, and support. Check out phsa.ca to learn more about this program and lend your voice to help create an inclusive and supportive system for trans members of our community.
Yeah, you touched on, you know, like the healthcare system, which is, I feel like, a big part of the conversation within all these intersections, but in its own way as well, of what anti-fatness like comes back to. So I guess, yeah, based on research that you've done, the stories that you've encountered and experience, whatever there may be, what do you feel like your thoughts are between the connection of the anti-fat bias and the issues of accessing the healthcare system?
Well, I think more broadly, public health is one of the biggest, and the medical institution at large is probably the biggest purveyor of anti-fat bias, because I think what many people use or weaponize to justify their poor treatment of fat people is this concept of health. And so in terms of how, can you repeat the end of your question again? Because it was a very like specific question and I want to make sure I touch on it in the way that you ask it.
But yeah, basically the question is, saying that in our last episode of Intersections, we discussed how anti-fat bias can affect access to the healthcare system for people that are perceived to be overweight. An example of this would be how certain conditions can be misdiagnosed as being caused by a high amount of body weight rather than actual pre-existing conditions. So based on your experience, your research, what are your thoughts on the connection between anti-fat bias and the issues coming back to access to the healthcare system?
This is a really complicated topic because I don't want to veer into the sort of healthist territory. Just how fatness is seen as a moral issue, health often is as well. And we often consider that there is a moral imperative to be healthy. And I do just sort of want to establish that no one owes anyone good health, and that it's a very personal relationship between yourself and your body and what that looks like. That being said, in terms of accessing healthcare, I mean, there's so many different ways you could approach that topic. There's accessibility issues. Like, I've been in the hospital before and I haven't had gowns in my size. I haven't fit necessarily into even the chairs in the waiting room. And I've also been treated very poorly by healthcare practitioners. I've had healthcare practitioners make assumptions just by looking at me instead of asking me about things like my lifestyle or my diet, meaning what I eat, not how I approach food, or anything like that. And I think that, you know, the old adage of making assumptions, I realize I can't swear, but essentially that making assumptions is a bad thing. We know that, right? As a society, we know that we shouldn't be making assumptions about anyone because that doesn't paint a factual picture of what might be going on. And yet doctors do it all the time. And that has very significant and severe consequences, including that a lot of fat folks are more statistically likely to die from certain conditions that could have been prevented or treated. And so accessing healthcare is not, you know, a superficial issue. It has very significant consequences. And yet, for whatever reason, we don't consider the, I guess fat stigma is just so strong that we don't consider the humanity of fat people, even within our healthcare system. And I think a lot of that comes down to the fact that fatness is framed as, within our sort of neoliberal capitalist society, as an individual responsibility. And therefore, if you are fat, you have failed in some way to maintain what we consider to be a viable body. And when we see things as an individual moral failure, we punish people for that. And so I think, you know, it's unfortunate, but it's true that if we see someone as to blame for their ailments, we don't feel a responsibility to still care for them. And we see that happen a lot. It takes 2 seconds to Google fat bias in the medical industry and just see how many people have died or have been severely harmed by this kind of neglect. And I think that we haven't mobilized to respond to it because a lot of us, or the majority of us, think that fat people deserve it. As well, like, the way we approach fatness in public health is often that it is better to be, or it is better to fight fatness than it is to fight anything else. So for example, if we consider weight loss surgery has high failure rates as well as very severe consequences, including that a lot of people die from it. And many public health professionals will still suggest that it is better to experience those symptoms, such as being, you know, chronically malnourished, having your hair fall out, experiencing ulcers, internal bleeding, or even the risk of dying, for the potential and statistically improbable possibility of being not fat. And so when we look at how we even construct the medical system to do basically anything to help someone not be fat, we can't be surprised then at how we treat fat people, and especially how we treat fat people who reject those interventions and instead want to be treated in the bodies that they're in right now.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I really like how you tied those two elements of like actual health and like how people are being, how people's identities and their value of existence becomes overlooked when the state of being fat, whatever that means, is decided on. And it's like you said, people's humanity is overlooked, and it really, we have a lot to question in the things that we have internalized and the stories that we are telling about fatness and about body weight, shape, look. So I really appreciate your insight.
Yeah, I think a lot of fat people are also afraid to advocate for themselves because being seen as difficult in that medical setting and with medical professionals as being gatekeepers to things that we need to survive means that there is an incredible power dynamic at play that no one else, I would say most people, aren't trying to fight or take down. And so for fat folks, you're kind of left with two choices. You either shut up and take the abuse or pander to the biases of your medical practitioners in the hopes that you will receive care, or you risk being labeled or categorized as a more difficult patient, which could compromise the quality of the care that you receive. And in either of those situations, fat people lose. And in both of those situations, their health is compromised. And there's really no winning. You know, there's no, at least in this moment, I can't really think of something that fat folks can do to mitigate that. And again, I think that speaks to the fact that we don't value fat people's lives. We don't want them to live, at least not in the bodies that they have.
Yeah, I really, I like how you word it like that, because I think a lot of people need to hear that, like, truth that, like, you don't see the humanity, and when you don't see the humanity in fat people, you're not going to treat them, you know, as an equal or as having that humanity, to say it again. So I want to just talk about like another intersection with like IC and fat studies. So just like understanding how gender plays into this. So we talked a little bit about this in our last episode. One of the things that I brought up is like, this is more, I guess, on like the idea of clothing, but I think also like it intersects with other stuff. So like, I'm a mask lesbian. So like, how I dress is very like dictated by my body. So like finding like that oversized clothes to wear is very difficult. It's more difficult than like, you know, a straight size person, a thin person. So yeah, I'm just wondering if you can speak more to how, again, like in your research, in your work, how you find this intersection of gender to work.
Oh, that's such a good topic. As a queer person myself, and as someone who identifies as gender nonconforming, I do often, or I have experienced fatness as a barrier to achieving my desired gender expression. And it's really unfortunate. I mean, just even looking at the fashion industry, the minimal amount of plus size clothing that exists is often hyper feminine. Which forces us, if we want to leave our homes, because we have to be clothed to go outside, it forces us into presenting in ways that often feel uncomfortable or don't align with who we are as people. And I think as well that the intersections of fatness and gender reveal the fat phobia within queer spaces. So even if we think about the concept of androgyny, for example, it's a very thin masculine of center aesthetic, which doesn't make any sense if you think about what androgyny is supposed to mean. The fact that it's masked, but also the fact that it's thin, is just a very bizarre sort of place that we've ended up in as a queer community, or as queer communities. But in terms of the intersections of gender and fatness, I mean, I can understand why we are in the situation that we are in if we look at the relationship between those two things. So fatness is often associated with the female body or female anatomy, and it is inherently ingrained or used, weaponized as a tool to support misogyny. So if we think about as well where fatness tends to occupy space on a lot of bodies, it's often the chest, the buttocks, the hips. And so when we think about it in that way, fatness can also feminize male bodies, right? And when we are looking to achieve ideal bodies or an ideal gendered body, it often involves the removal or manipulation of fat to a different area. And again, we see that even in trans communities, right? Like the removal of fat from fat tissue from the chest or removal of fat tissue from the hips to achieve what is upheld as a desirable trans body, or, you know, placing fatness or body fat in different parts, just kind of all works together to reaffirm anti-fat bias. And it's difficult as someone who is not interested in any type of medical manipulation of my body or surgical manipulation of my body. I often struggle with the idea that I might never achieve an outward expression that aligns with how I identify and how I feel. And I don't know what the solution is for that. I mean, I think that it just, like I said, reveals how complicated and sort of interwoven all of these things are. But it also goes to show that even the more queer or radical spaces also perpetuate similar ideas. And so for fat people and fat queers in particular, we're kind of left in this very lonely sort of floating where we don't really fit into any of the communities that we are trying to access. And that makes me sad because I think there are easy solutions. Like, I don't think it's that difficult to design clothing in larger sizes. I don't think it's that difficult to think about inclusivity when you're starting a company or a brand or what have you. There are a very small handful of businesses that undertake that responsibility. And often they're also inaccessible class-wise. Like, it's quite expensive to access those things. And that's something that we refer to as a fat tax. So it's these like additional costs that we have to take on in order to survive as fat people. So if you wanted to buy more masculine or center clothing, or let's say you needed a suit for an event, you might have to order that custom made from a designer in New York City. And whereas someone else who isn't fat could walk into any of the stores on Robson Street and find a suit. So it's unfair. It's unfair. And it's frustrating.
Yeah, everything you said is completely all of the thoughts that I have. And I like that you made the connection between the queer space, because I think a lot of times queer people get too comfortable in their inclusivity and they don't acknowledge anything beyond like a thin white queer body, which is not all that queerness is. And yeah, I just think that's an excellent point to end off this interview. Thank you so much, Layla, for being here. Just for our listeners, can you tell them where to find more about your work, where to follow you?
Sure, yeah. I have a website, laylacameron.com. On Twitter, I'm at layla_Cameron. And my business that I run, that I will be announcing the podcast through, is called Stay Fat Design Co. And you can find it at that handle on pretty much any platform.
Awesome. Thank you so much for being here today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It was nice to chat with both of you.
Thanks, Layla.
Thank you for listening to Intersections, presented by CITR's Gender Empowerment Collective at 101.9 FM. We can always be reached by email at genderempowerment@citr.ca or on Instagram at genderempowerment_CITR for comments, feedback, and topic ideas.
You can find our episode archive and show notes at citr.ca/radio/intersections. This episode of Intersections was made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Radio Meters program. Our theme song is provided by John Allison Weiss. Tune in again in 2 weeks on Tuesday at 10 a.m. to catch our next episode.